Today is Monday, July 6th, 2020. This is part 17 of a Grand Canyon oral history interview with Charles Butch Farabee, spelled F-A-R-A-B-E-E. My name is Tom Martin. Good afternoon, Butch. How are you today?
Good, Tom. Thanks.
Thank you. May we have your permission to record this oral history over the telephone?
Yes.
Thank you very much. Last time we were talking about a number of different things that were happening in Grand Canyon, and as they related to helicopters and the helicopter overflights issues. Other things that were happening at the park that you got interested or involved in were the entertaining the Prince of Japan, and that was pretty interesting. Were there any other management plans or activities that happened at Grand Canyon that you recall and want to talk about?
Well, yeah, there's a couple, but one was, as it turns out, and I've seen this touted elsewhere, that there are more wild caves in Grand Canyon National Park than in any other national park area in the country.
So, as a caver, I'll jump in and ask you right now, you should know, is that right?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I didn't go around counting them all, but there are a lot of caves in the Grand Canyon, pretty much none of which are known except to a small group of cavers in the state or you know, around the state. But, you know, I do belong to and have for 60-some years the National Speleological Society. And, you know, they've given me little recognitions over the years as being one of the early people, certainly not the founders, but one of the early people. So, I maintain this interest in caving in the Grand Canyon, or, you know, at that time of my life, which is, you know, I could still actually get on my hands and knees and crawl into a cave, I guess. So, but one of the events that took place that really had a significant impact on the resources of the Grand Canyon was an event where I ended up arresting two river runners. I don't remember the name of the one young man, but the second was a guy by the name of Hans, H-A-N-S, Bodenhammer, which I think is B-O-D-E-N-H-A-M-E-R. That's pretty close, Hans Bodenhammer, who actually lived in Glacier, or not in Glacier, but in Montana, close to Glacier National Park. But at the time, I think, that was probably not right. At the time, he was probably living in Flagstaff, although I got to know him later while he was living in Montana, so that was a Montana connection.
Okay.
And I apologize for screwing this up. But in I think it was December of 82, I went back and looked at a news clipping. We got a report of two river runners who had launched from Lee's Ferry, and whoever made the report, I don't remember much about any of that, but it was pretty clear to the reporting party that, like, these guys were not really river runners. I mean, they really weren't prepared for what they were going to get themselves into. And it was just sort of a wild river rafting trip, which we, you know, had several over the years, I'm sure even long before I was there. But, and, you know, we needed to go in. So Kim Johnson, K-I-M Johnson, J-O-H-N-S-O-N, Johnson, who was quite an accomplished rafter, kayaker, and she was a ranger in the river unit at the park. But she didn't have any law enforcement authority. But she had the knowledge that I did not have, So the two of us flew in. Somehow, she sort of second-guessed where they would be based on the time that they were reported to leave Lee's Ferry, sort of thing. And so we flew in by helicopter, and we were able to spot them. And they were in camp. They had beached, not too far down below Lee's Ferry, I think above, upstream of the Little Colorado, someplace in there. So we landed, and these guys admitted to, just doing this expedition that you can do when you're 19 or 20 years old, but perhaps have not thought it through very well. And they had some pretty cheap rafts. These are just little two-man rafts. And I don't know. I mean, who knows if they would have lived through all this, but we didn't want that to happen, of course, them to get hurt. So anyway, I sighted them, and then we physically removed them from that spot. And we slung load, we had the helicopter ended up, we bundled everything up, and they helped us, of course, put everything into the big net, a sling, and we slung out their rafts, and we slung out all their equipment and stuff. And then we flew these two kids out, these young men out, and cited them into court. I think I said that I arrested them. I definitely cited them, and whether I released them with a citation after actually arresting them or not, I can't frankly say that. But they were, they had been detained and cited for sure. So they eventually appeared in front of the U.S. magistrate there in the park, and their fine was to pay for the helicopter flights, the sling loading, Kim's and my flight in, their flight out, that sort of thing. And there was probably, maybe four or five round trips from this beach to the South Rim. So in those days, that was a pretty significant piece of money, probably several thousand dollars, which was what the judge fined them, and that was it. Well, as it turns out, Hans was also a very avid caver. And northern Arizona's got a lot of wild caves. Some of them are limestone, some of them are sandstone, some of them are earth cracks, which are very deep, 300 and 400 feet deep. And Hans was right in the middle of all that. And at that point, I was about 40 years old, and I was still very interested in caving, although I wasn't doing much caving because of my job demand and raising two boys. But Hans and I got to be pretty good acquaintances, and I was able to talk him into volunteering for Grand Canyon to get, really jump into the cave program at the canyon, which was basically non-existent. There was no geologist or hydrologist, at least not full-time for the park. There wasn't anybody who was, had a focus on caving. And so I sort of adopted that, even though it was not in my position description, just because of my roughly 20-some years worth of cave experience that I brought with me to that job.
Okay.
And so Hans was very agreeable to this, and we helped, introduced him to the resource people there. I think it was Steve Hodapp by that time was the chief of resources management. And I think everybody in that group knew that there were caves and that was something that we need to look at, but nobody had ever taken really on taken it on their, put it on their plate to work on.
So can I yeah. just kind of paint the scene here a little bit? Grand Canyon, in its 277 miles of length, roughly 240 miles of that is through very karst limestone. Which karst means it's got cavities in it. It's like Swiss cheese.
Yeah.
And a lot of these caves are at the top of the rock unit, top of the red wall limestone. So there'll be a 700 foot drop, and 50 feet down from the top is a 100 foot or not 100 but 50 foot diameter opening, and every half mile to 2 miles, there's another one. And there's a lot of red wall exposure out there. And so that's what I think why you get that carte blanche. Oh, more caves in Grand Canyon than anywhere else. That's really true, but most of them are not accessible to ordinary folks. And that brings us to Hans Bodenhammer, because I sure don't see him as an ordinary person.
No, Hans is not ordinary.
Can you tell me about what his manner was like? Was he an angry young man, or was he different? And what kind of skill set did he possess?
Well, as I remember Hans, he was quiet, had a real sense of adventure about him, which of course I admire that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and cavers in general are pretty secretive about the location of caves. They're not unwilling to talk about caving, but they don't like to reveal where caves are, just because, you know, the general public is very prone to screwing these places up. So Hans was quiet in that manner. He was very respectful. He wasn't angry or belligerent or obnoxious. I mean, he was just a nice guy.
Well, some people said he had a really sharp sense of humor.
Well, he may have. I don't really remember that kind of detail.
Okay.
I mean, it wasn't like we sat around and, me drinking a Diet Coke and him drinking a beer or anything.
Uh-huh.
The relationship really wasn't like that.
Okay.
But it was more of a quasi-professional relationship.
Mm-hmm.
And, I'm generally very respectful to pretty much everybody. And I'm certainly very respectful of people that have like interests that, I like or I admire.
Mm-hmm.
And Hans was one of them. But even though I wasn't sitting around, having jokes with him. But I can't remember exactly. But he was, 20 or young, early 20s, at that point. And again, I don't remember anything about his rafting partner. He sort of dropped out of the scene, I think, once they paid their bill.
Mm-hmm.
With the magistrate. And, he didn't fight anything. He didn't, voice any real dissent about what had happened to him. I think he was pretty clued in that this was an illegal trip and that he, if he could get away with it, great, but if he didn't get away with it, he was willing to pay the consequences as well. And I guess I like that about anybody, sort of confess up to what you've done.
Mm-hmm.
And move on. And Hans is one of them. But over time, in the Grand Canyon, there are lots of archaeology sites as well, and some of them are in these caves. And one of the more famous artifacts are these split twig figurines that are actually quite common in the park, although it took a while before anybody recognized the fact that there are a lot of these little willow figurines, sort of hidden, buried in the dirt in some of these shelters and caves. But a lot of the, particularly in the North Rim, there are some very big caves. I mean, some caves that have got a lot of miles to them. And probably, some on the South Rim. I only know of a couple. So, but Hans, because of his interest and the fact that our resource people were willing to sort of bring him into the fold because he had some knowledge or was able to get some knowledge of things that we were to protect, we meaning the park, and was within our realm of responsibility, but no one at that time had any real inclination or interest about caving per se. And, to go into wild caves takes a certain mentality. Not everybody is suited for it just because of the claustrophobia, the need for, climbing experience and, just being underground, a lot of people don't want to do that. So, but Hans brought all this experience and all this interest with him, and over the years that I was there, he would interact and interface with the resource guys, and periodically I'd see him and, come up and sit down with them and go through, some of the things that he was doing. I didn't supervise him in any fashion. I had no real control over what he might be doing. But just because of our initial relationship, I was involved. And so I think over time, Hans had quite a contribution to the park. And then, I don't know exactly what happened to him in the interim, but when I was the... either the acting or the deputy superintendent at Glacier National Park in Montana, I ran across Hans again. And by this time, Hans is roughly, 15 years older. He's become a teacher. And he teaches at the local high school, the Blackfeet Reservation, which is contiguous, is right next door to Glacier. And we interacted with that group, those Native Americans, that tribe, a lot, the park did. And I did as well. So I found out that Hans was a teacher. I think he taught, biology and some of the sciences at the high school there, local high school. But he had also formed a cave club within the school, and he was taking these young men and women, probably a group of, 10 or 12 anyway, into the park, and they were, starting to do some mapping and expose these young people, his students, to caving, but science as well. And, so Hans made a real effort to do that because of his love for caving, and I suspect his love for teaching as well. And then over time, I know that Hans would take these groups, these young men and women clubs, they actually went to the Grand Canyon on a number of occasions. And the park, the resource people would welcome them and help them facilitate them doing some cave measuring, looking for figurines perhaps, just documenting some of the caves. And I think mostly on the South Rim, if I recall. And Hans was no longer actually at that point, was no longer working for the Blackfeet or the Blackfoot tribe. Rather, he was a high school teacher in Columbia Falls, which was a small town right at the base, right near Glacier National Park. So, you know, Hans over the years has been a real contributor to the cave knowledge of the Grand Canyon. And now the park has a hydrologist, maybe a geologist, and caves are within that person's responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
And I have not followed too much of that, of what that person is doing. I often think, well, I ought to get, maybe contact him and just introduce myself and, you know, maybe give him a little bit of this history as well. Not that it would make too much difference, perhaps, but so I think the park is starting to recognize its responsibility with the caves.
Yes.
In the park. And, you know, the figure that comes to my mind, and I would never want to be quoted on this, is something like over 600 caves are known. And some of them, even Tom, you know about some of these that empty into the Colorado. I mean, Vasey's Paradise is one of them.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I think, I've never been in Vasey's, but I've got friends here in Tucson that have, and it goes for miles. And
yes.
It's a particularly complex cave. I did some wild caving while I was there, a couple of caves, and the one that, you know, I remember the best was, way down at Thunder River. What's the, do you remember the canyon that goes right into the water there?
Deer Creek Falls, it's Surprise Valley.
Yeah.
And Deer Creek Valley. And then there's Tepetz Creek.
Yeah, Tepetz.
Okay.
There. I couldn't remember Tepetz.
Got it.
Well, at the upper end of Tepetz Canyon, a river,
mm-hmm.
stream, which is not very long, a couple miles at the most, it goes into a cave. That's where the water comes from.
Right.
And at the very back of that cave is the largest room, at least up until not too many years ago, is the largest room by volume in the state of Arizona. I mean, it's huge. And we swam into it, this other ranger and myself, and a guy from, yeah, this ought to be recorded here. A guy by the name of Bob Beecher, B-O-E-C-H-E-R, who was an old-time caver here in Tucson. When I was the assistant chief ranger and I had responsibility for search and rescue, I also knew that we had the real potential to have a real serious rescue and or search in the park from a caver. And, you know, within the park, we didn't have the expertise. We ended up doing a little cave, and I mentioned a little rescue in a cave, which
mm-hmm.
I mentioned some time back, Cave of the Domes. And
right.
So, but I also knew it could get much bigger, much more dangerous, much more complicated, and much more involved. So I went out to, you know, I got the addresses and phone numbers of cavers within the state of Arizona, because I still belong to the Caving Club of America, the National Speleological Society. And I got, and they, you know, they put out a membership booklet every year.
Mm-hmm.
So I went through and I identified, I don't know, maybe 10 or so people that lived around the state. And I ended up calling these guys. And I said, if we were to have a serious need for cavers on a cave rescue, could I count on you to help out?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and everybody said, yes, for sure. So I came up with a list. I had my call-out list and addresses and phone numbers and stuff for this cave group, including this one guy, this Bob Beecher. And so I invited him up to the park. I said, if you want to go, because somehow we got to talking about, or maybe he mentioned to me, Tapetes, which is T-A-P-E-A-T-S, Tapetes. I said, if I could get us in there easily, would you like to go and you could be our guide into Tapetes Cave? And he, well, for sure. So the Inner Canyon Ranger, whose name has just sort of slipped me at the moment. I don't know if that's a dangerous sign or not.
You and the rest of us. It's.
Yeah, well, I hope so, I guess. So the three of us, and Tom Caldwell was our pilot again,
okay,
that I mentioned before. And at the Pete's, there's also a little campground, and there's a pit toilet there with a structure mm-hmm. on it. And at that time, it needed some work. There was some, it was basically falling apart. So we made a, we took in, some building equipment, carpentry equipment, boards and things to stabilize this outhouse. And we also took in wetsuits and caving equipment and camping gear. It was all in one trip. We were able to do it with one.
Wow, that was a heavy ship.
Well, it wasn't. I'm making it sound a lot heavier than it was. It wasn't like we had a huge number of boards, but enough to do a nice job.
Well, just four adults and camping supplies and and wetsuit gear for three of them.
Yeah, well, I mean, you're right. I mean, but I'm almost positive we did it in one trip.
Okay.
So Tom ends up landing us at the mouth of the cave down in the canyon.
Wow.
Only literally within maybe 200 feet of the mouth of this cave. There was a big boulder he was able to put down. And you know, everything was done safely. Of course, the pilot is the one that makes these kinds of decisions. But, you know, he was, whatever, we did it fine and no problems. And I think prior to that, my mind is a little foggy on this, but we had dumped off the lumber and, you know, the building equipment at the right spot. So we flew in, and Bob takes us into this cave, and it's really one of the funnest trips I've been on. We had to swim through the stalagmites and the stalactites and work your way into the cave. And when you get all the way in the back, and it's a couple of hour trip to get to the back, and you're in wetsuits because the water is actually very cold. In my case, I just wore a wetsuit top. I didn't wear bottoms. And there's a huge room. I mean, it's a cathedral in there. It's really spectacular. And it ends in a wall. You know, somehow there's been an earth shift, you know, an earthquake or something. And, you know, this wall of... I don't know if it was sandstone, but it was not limestone anyway, has shifted. And so this big room is, you know, ends. I mean, there's this big blank wall. And, you know, the water is seeping out from underneath it, I guess. And there's a register at the back of this room where you have to, people could sign in. And the last person to have signed in was like 5 or 7 years before, and it was the same guy, this Bob Beecher, that was with us.
Okay.
And so then we went out and did our, you know, spent the night and worked on the outhouse and did, you know, justified our trip, I guess. But I don't think I had to justify it too much because, you know, Rangers had not been in this cave before, even though it's very accessible. River runners and their groups go into it with some frequency. So there was a need to know about it to get a better handle for it. It wasn't all fun and games, although we certainly enjoyed it, you know, there was a necessity, as well as repairing this outhouse. So, you know, sort of summarize the caving thing at the Grand Canyon. There are a lot of caves. Some of them, and I don't have any real feel for how many, are very complicated, very dangerous. If something were to go wrong, it'd be a real effort. You know, not only from a safety standpoint, a rescue standpoint, of course, the bigger issue is just keeping track of the caves and, you know, the hydrology.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what's, you know, none of this I know much about. It's just that it's a whole dimension of resource management that sort of out of sight, out of mind,
yeah.
But in fact is an important aspect of, you know, what the National Park Service does in terms of preservation and resource, you know, management, resource management. So, you know, in an offhanded way, I take a little credit for having pushed that aspect of our knowledge about the park along.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, and that was, you know, through Hans largely. So.
Yeah, hasn't his work in Glacier discovered some of the largest caves in the country? I mean, it's just some phenomenally huge cave system.
Yeah. Or in the Marshall Wilderness too.
Yeah. Just amazing work that he's done.
Yeah. Well, Glacier had, when I was there, we only had like 5 known caves, and I suspect that Hans and his group, you know, discovered more.
Hmm.
And whether they had any relationship to, you know, the early Americans or not, I don't know. You know, that is one of the things at the Grand Canyon was just, you know, these split twig figurines that, you know, became not commonplace, but became, there were a lot of them. And, you know, there was a lot of not only complex caves, but some of these big shelters were also, you know, homes or at least transient shelters for the early peoples of that area. So, you know, it's an important aspect of management of the park. So I don't know what else to say about Hans or caves, I guess. I sort of shot my wad there.
No, that's really good. You know, Bodenhammer is just a pretty fascinating guy. And my time with him, he was very friendly, very collegial, very, very helpful, generous, but very amazingly resource-oriented and resource-protective.
Yeah.
Sort of the perfect caver's caver.
Yeah, no, I mean, I didn't ever go caving with them, and I didn't sit down and talk about caves in general, but I did get that feeling, which is the reason I think that I was interested in encouraging a relationship with he in the park.
Because
mm-hmm. I, you know, I saw something in Hans, even though he was a pretty young man at the time, that I thought would be worth cultivating. And it's paid off, I'm sure, in many ways, not only for the Grand Canyon, but for other places as well, elsewhere.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely.
So, and I think one of the other things you wanted me to mention was Governor Babbitt.
Yes, please.
being lost for a while.
Yes, how do you lose the governor of a state?
You know, it's one of those things where if you've ever been on a search, lots of times you find out, you know, the people don't think that they're lost, and then probably they weren't lost. It's just that the people that are concerned about them didn't know where they were.
Right, right.
So, and which is is one of the, you know, that was one of the overriding things I did with when I was really involved in search and rescue, particularly in Yosemite. There were any number of times when I would drag my feet, whereas probably other people wouldn't be quite so cavalier about this, but I would drag my feet and basically say, you know, this person is very accomplished. He's 25 years old. He's in good health, la-di-da, la-di-da. Let's give him some opportunity to work himself out of whatever dilemma he's gotten himself into.
Right.
Rather than, you know, going hell-bent leather to try to find him. And when we find him, he's going to find out, well, what's the big deal? I'm perfectly fine. I wasn't hurt or anything. So that's the same case with the governor. I've written it down here. November 12th and 13th, 1983, the Arizona governor, Babbitt, who probably knew the park better than most of us, was on a, he caught a river trip out of Lee's Ferry, and it was sort of an ad hoc kind of a thing on his part. It was not uncommon for him to come into the park, and oftentimes we wouldn't even know he was there. He'd go hiking or exploring or something.
Mm-hmm.
And he did that before, and he did it after, he was governor. But on this occasion, he was the governor, and he'd caught this river trip out of Lee's Ferry, and they got caught, and I'm not so sure I remember all the nuances to this, but they ended up beaching, not too far down the river, probably, above the Little Colorado, for sure, upstream of Little Colorado, between there and Lee's Ferry. And there are several escape routes, there are several canyons that intersect, and I've hiked four or five of them myself, and Tom probably has as well, if not more. And that's what he was going to do.
Okay.
He had told people. It wasn't like he was doing this totally by himself. But somehow there was some delay involved. And I get a call from his security group, which is the Department of Public Safety, or the Highway Patrol, if you will. And they have a several-man detail that's supposed to keep track of him provide some bodyguarding kinds of things. And they don't know where he is. And, they're in quasi-panic because it's not a good thing for them to lose their main objective, which is the governor. And, somehow they sort of shift it to my shoulders. And all of a sudden, it's your park. You guys know the area. And right. You know the people and all
find
that.
Them. Yeah.
Can you help us find them? Well, that's it's not really a question. We don't really have a way to get out of it. That was our job. We needed to help get this guy out of there. So I enlist. I take the responsibility and say, okay, we're going to work on this and we'll see what we can do. I didn't envision the governor drowning or anything. I guess I wasn't too worried about him personally, again, because he was a very accomplished outdoors person and knows the park and knows his limitations, and I felt comfortable about that.
Mm-hmm.
But I enlisted the aid of Kim Crumbo, C-R-U-M-B-O, who was our lead river rafter, river ranger. And, these men and women who run the river all the time, they develop a sixth sense, but they also have some good idea of, well, okay, if you launch at 3 in the afternoon and you're in such and such a kind of boat, and it's either motorized or not motorized, you can go X far.
Right.
They know that. And, they can probably pinpoint it within pretty close accuracy, actually. which is what Kim ends up doing, but he ends up spending the night. We put the park helicopter, we fly Kim up to meet with the Department of Public Safety guys who are in, is it Navajo Springs?
Bitter Springs?
Not Bitter Springs. It's on 89.
Right.
Where it splits off and goes over by the Vermilion Cliffs, right at the base of the hill going into Page.
Yeah. Where Highway 89 splits from Highway 89A.
Yeah. Is that Navajo Springs? Whatever it is, there's a little community there.
Yeah. Yeah.
Mostly just houses, Bureau of Indian Affairs houses.
Right.
And that's where his guard group, his helicopter and his bodyguards, his protection detail are based out of. And so we fly Kim up there and they're looking over the maps, and I'm pretty sure, and I was not there when this was taking place. I'm sort of doing the big picture person and keeping the governor's office informed. And I think we're trying to keep the press out of this at that point.
Mm-hmm.
The governor ends up spending the night at this particular spot. He's perfectly fine. I'm sure he and the river runners or maybe even the guests with the river guys were just having a fabulous time, right? And the governor was going to be hiking out one of these side canyons. Well, because of being caught late at night and then, governor kinds of responsibilities and obligations the next day.
Right.
Higher patrol flies in and picks him up. Now, for one thing, they're on the Navajo side. They're on the Indian side. They're not in the park, technically, anyway, when they pick him up. So there wasn't any real brouhaha about any of that. And I guess, probably anyway, had it even been in the park, we would have given him permission. We wouldn't have even asked, probably. We would have just said,
go do it.
Get it over with.
Have a good day.
Yeah, have a good day. About it. But, we didn't have that kind of little minor embarrassment because it was on the tribe side. So, it all worked out fine, and the governor was probably a little bit red-faced, but not too much. And did make the newspaper, but the story was about 2 inches high. It really didn't end up getting any kind of real press,
mm-hmm.
which was probably a good thing. But I got to tell you that for about 8 or 10 hours, I was running around with my head like a chicken with his head cut off, trying to resolve some of these and keep contact and run interference between DPS and the governor's office and the superintendent, of course. So that's just one of the little minor things that cropped up along the way, but it was an interesting experience. And, I knew Governor Babbitt well enough that he knew me. I mean, he would remember my name. It wasn't like we were buddy-buddy.
Mm-hmm.
But, because he was in the park quite a bit. He actually took a 3-day cross-country ski trip, which I organized for him, from on the North Rim.
Nice.
Skied out, and we put him up in the entrance station cabin with one of our rangers, Joe Kuros. And the governor asked if I wanted to take this trip, and I could have easily done it. I was a pretty fair cross-country skier, and I could have easily done the trip. It was just that I thought I'd like to get younger people exposed to this sort of thing, just for the fun of doing it and the satisfaction they might have.
Mm-hmm.
And so I got a nice young guy by the name of Churros, Q-U-I-R-O-Z, Joe Churros, who was married to the local doctor at the time, Cheryl Pagel. And then, you know, once they got to the top of the North Kaibab Trail, you know, the governor and everybody hikes across, comes out on the south rim. It was, you know, a long day for him.
Yeah.
But the governor was up to it. I mean, he was a pretty remarkable guy when it came to that sort of thing.
Yeah.
So I guess I could shut up about the governor. That's about... So what else did we want to talk about, Tom? I forgot.
The only other thing we had talked about kind of off tape about some things was the helicopter flying at night. But I think you'd covered that to a certain extent, unless there was more you wanted to mention about that.
Well, not too much. I mean, you know, from a policy standpoint, from a practical standpoint, we never put the single engine helicopter, which is what we had, up at night. But there were some exceptions. I know over time, and while I was there a couple of times, we flew into the river, into the inner gorge, landing on a beach at night for somebody like who has had a heart attack, and if you don't get him out right now, he's going to die kind of situation.
Mm-hmm.
All of this was up to the pilot. If a pilot was willing to do it and felt everything was safe and probably there was enough moon to make it reasonable.
Right.
Because in the canyon itself, with a full moon, it's pretty bright.
Yeah.
It doesn't take much. And you had mentioned night vision goggles. We didn't have those in those days.
Right.
But even with a full moon or a decent moon, there's so much reflection off of the rocks and things.
Mm-hmm.
And particularly for a pilot that has some sense as to where everything is. So we did that on occasion. One time I mentioned, you know, we went up just looking for a fire across on the north rim of a campfire of somebody that we were searching for. And we saw the campfire. But the guys that we were searching for were faster than we were. They hiked out. They were way ahead of us. Like they were like 10 miles. We sort of leapfrogged all the way around by helicopter following these guys. And they pretty much got out before we found them. I mean, we ended up making contact with them.
Mm-hmm.
A couple of times, you know, we flew to the North Rim for the same medical reason. Somebody on the North Rim was having a serious issue, and Ernie, or perhaps even Sherry Collins, and there was another paramedic that we had at that time, too. We actually had a couple more. We had about four over time. But we would send somebody over on the North Rim to pick up somebody, and one or two occasions, they'd go straight to Flagstaff. I mean, they recognize that there's no reason to stop at the little hospital there to the South Rim.
Right. The level of acuity is high enough that going directly to a higher level trauma center is a better idea.
That's exactly right. And, they're probably all good calls, and you leave it up to the people that are in the ship.
Yeah.
To some degree, I had a responsibility to say yay or nay.
Mm.
But at the same time, the pilot, you trusted the pilot, you trusted your ranger on the scene, usually a paramedic,
mm-hmm.
to make a decent decision. So we didn't abuse that. We didn't do it very often because there really was a liability aspect to it. But I think everybody on those few occasions thought that the end justified the means in this case. So, And now I don't know what they really do. They probably don't do too much more than we did then.
That's right. Well, but you know that decision is made in the field about where you want to take the person that's now in your charge, depending on their symptoms.
Yeah. And
you know, is the clinic open? You know, what's the level of trauma involved? You know, all those considerations.
Yeah. But you know, the alternative for something on North Rim would be to put them in an ambulance and take them all the way out to Kanab, at least.
Right.
Or yeah, I suppose Kanab, maybe even Page. I'm not sure.
Right, Page or Vegas. Those are the options.
Yeah.
But that's a lot. You know, it's a lot of travel time.
For that.
Yeah. So, in rolling back to the spring of 1987, actually the summer of 87, and you ended up moving to Washington, D.C.
Yeah, I think it was roughly June of 87. I had been offered this job, decided to take it. My kids, you know, I was a single parent at this point. I had been, actually, for a long time. You know, my wife and I had joint custody, but because I'm the one that had the bigger job and I had the house at Grand Canyon, and which was in my name, you know, renting, and, I ended up taking the, you know, the most of the raising or them living with me.
Mm-hmm.
So I went back to the Grant to Washington D.C. by myself at that point. My kids were spending the summer with their mother in Flagstaff, which worked out real well for me because it gave me an opportunity to find a place to live and get my feet on the ground and get some ideas as to how much traveling I'll need to do and how much work and, you know, the lay of the land, and Washington, D.C. is a pretty interesting place in any number of ways, and there are a number of ways that affected me, but one was just the sheer traffic in D.C. is horrendous.
Hmm.
So where I lived out in Herndon, which is Herndon, Virginia, which is very close to Dulles Airport, you know, the commute was about a 45-minute commute, and I ended up getting into a carpool, which is very customary for most people. Carpools in Washington, D.C. are, I mean, they actually have offices within these various buildings and various departments, like the Department of Interior, who do nothing but coordinate.
Wow.
Carpools and get people, you know, putting people with a carpool. I mean, it's that big a thing to them. And the carpool I belonged to, my boss, Walt Dabney, and I were in the same carpool. There were three other guys, and as a rule, there were five of us that would go in, take about 45 minutes if we hit the traffic right. So, you know, at a certain hour, and this is really kind of interesting from my thought anyway, is when you're in these big cabinet or big official meetings, which I was in some, at a certain time rolls by, people that are involved will essentially stand up and walk out of the room because their carpool is leaving.
Wow.
And that was, you know, if I was in a meeting with the Secretary of the Interior, and that wouldn't be just me, but, you know, with several other people, I don't know how much we would have abused it then, but for underneath that, like the Deputy Secretary and Assistant Secretaries, we would get up and leave. I mean, we would be very polite and courteous and excuse ourselves, but everybody understood how important a carpool was, particularly for those of us that didn't have parking privileges. You know, I wasn't far enough up the totem pole to have my own parking spot, which I wouldn't want to have done anyway. The driving and the traffic, it's just terrible in D.C. So, you know, that 3 months worth of my being back there by myself allowed me the opportunity to figure these things all out, get myself adjusted to where I was living. I bought my first house, which was a townhouse. It was only 900 square feet, had three little bedrooms to it. And I just, a couple of days ago, my youngest son sent me a photo of him standing in front of this little townhouse in Herndon, Virginia. So, you know, because living in a national park, you know, I lived in Lake Mead. I lived in Glen Canyon, Lake Mead, Yosemite, Death Valley, Grand Canyon, all was government housing. I couldn't buy anything. And so, for one thing, I didn't build any equity, you know. And so my first little house there in D.C., I was a GS-13. It was a promotion, which is like a major in the military. So I ended up, you know, getting my feet wet by a lot of things, including being a homeowner now. So, you know, I don't know what you want me to say about me actually moving back there.
No, you know, one thing, let's touch upon, because I think it's important. You mentioned that as a field ranger, going from remote location to remote location, from service unit to service unit to service unit, it is very difficult to purchase a house in a community and then basically either have to be an absentee landowner or an absentee renter, if you're going to rent that property out, to build equity, which the average citizen gets a job and gets a loan and buys a house and puts down a mortgage. And well, at least in those days, that was the thing. But you weren't alone in the cadre of rangers that were living in the parks they worked at and didn't have the opportunity to go in that investment route of investing in a home over decades of payments and then finally making last payment and having, you know, an investment, if you will, or even very much simply a place to retire to.
Yeah, no, that's all true. There's in a job, in a position description, you know, that you have to adhere to, if you will. There's a caveat in there that says required occupancy.
Okay.
Which makes a lot of sense. I mean, if you're on the south rim of the Grand Canyon, there isn't much opportunity to own a place outside the park and live, at least. You might be able to buy something for, you know, build some sort of equity up outside the park, but you couldn't almost not live there. You had to live in the park. It was required occupancy.
Okay.
Now, it also became a tax deduction. You could deduct, you know, the rent, because that's what we paid, was rent, on where you lived because you were required to live there. And a place like Yosemite Valley, at least in those days, if you needed to be there because of search and rescue, because of fires, because of EMS and whatever, law enforcement, you were required to live in the park. But when I moved to Washington, D.C., there was no such animal. I was not a required occupant. There wasn't any, you know, there might have been an exception or two, but there weren't any places you were required to live.
Mm-hmm.
And in my case, this was the first house that I had the opportunity to buy. I was nervous about it, had never done this before.
How old were you?
My lady friend at the time, that I'd been going with for quite some time, Karen English, she went back there with me to help find a place to live. You know, and she had two kids, and I had two kids, and so she had some sense as to what do I need, what can I afford to give to them, what, you know, size-wise, et cetera. And
so that must have been tough with a three-person, 900-square-foot townhouse with six people in it.
Well, no. Well, she doesn't live there. No, just the three of us.
Okay.
Myself and my two sons.
Okay.
But I wanted to be able to give my sons each a little bedroom.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the oldest at that time was, I think, about 11. The youngest was maybe 8.
How old were you at the time? 87?
Well, I wasn't 87. So in 1987, I would have been about 35, I think, right?
Okay.
42 to, yeah, isn't that right? 35 years.
Okay.
And, you know, it's a nice little community, Herndon, but it's a long ways away from downtown D.C. I had an interesting experience. I mean, to show you, how this works from a, you know, single father perspective, moving his kids back. I had two vehicles, and so I had a Volkswagen van, which I had forever.
Mm-hmm.
So the kids and I are driving across, coming across the United States and doing some sightseeing and stuff. And we get to Washington, and rather than go straight to the house, you know, where they're going to end up living for, turns out, for 4 years, I decide to show them some of the iconic kinds of places in Washington, D.C. that they've only seen photos of,
mm-hmm.
including, like, the Washington Monument.
Right.
And, I wasn't all that good on the road system there for a while anyway, and I was going to show them, I was going to drive around the mall, which meant that I, on one side you got the Jefferson Memorial, on the other side you got the Lincoln Memorial, and right in front of you is the Washington Monument, and way over there is the White House, and you know, all these iconic kinds of places, and I thought this would really be neat, be a nice way to introduce them to their new home.
Mm-hmm.
And I got lost on the road system, and I ended up driving by into Reagan International Airport. At that time, it's called National Airport, which is, you know, main airport, sort of downtown D.C. And there's a place where you can drive to the end of the runway, and the landing planes will be, you know, 1,500 feet above you when they're coming in.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people just sit out there and watch the planes come and go. I mean,
yeah.
Sort of thing. So I didn't tell my kids that I was lost because I was trying to get to, you know, the mall.
Uh-huh.
But I didn't know how to find the end of the runway. So I ended up taking my kids to the end of the runway, and I was diverting their attention, so they were watching the big planes come in 100 feet over their head, which is pretty thrilling.
Mm-hmm.
But in the meantime, I'm getting the map of Washington, D.C. out, trying to figure out how the heck to get to where I really want to go. And we haven't even gone to our house yet, right? So, you know, it was bewildering to me. I was out of my element, that was for sure. And when I accepted that job, you know, from having, as you very aptly described, living in these remote areas, going from one to the next, and that was sort of my mindset and what I enjoyed doing and felt comfortable in doing. So I went back there with two thoughts in mind. One was, if I can get out of here, if I cannot get out of here, in meaning that if I don't have the credentials and the I guess the well, credentials is the best word, I suppose, to get out of there, that I didn't deserve to get out of there. You know, I didn't deserve to be in competition with somebody else. That was one mindset, which is sort of very unusual for most of my peers, who were pretty reluctant to go to these central offices because they're afraid to get they'd get caught there.
Right.
And I said, told myself, well, if I get caught there, it's because I don't deserve to get out of here.
Mm.
And then the second thing was, I said, you know, Washington, D.C. and all of its complications, socially, professionally, logistically, like the roads, is nothing more than a wilderness area, and I just have to learn how to work my way between the trees.
That's right.
To get to do or be or, you know, whatever I needed to do. And, you know, once I came to grips with that, you know, like almost overnight, I realized, you know, I laid back and became comfortable with what I was doing. You know, it wasn't like I was, you know, everything was easy. It was just that I understood what I needed to do better. And that's how I conducted the next 4 years of my life, was under those concepts or precepts or whatever the right term is.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
So anyway, we got back to Washington, D.C., and, you know, my kids, they blossomed back there. I mean, they had a, you know, they came from a little tiny school at the Grand Canyon, and the teachers were very good. And, of course, it's a closed community or a close community.
Right.
And everybody knows everybody, and you get to be, you know, on first names of the teachers and, you know, socialize and, you know, almost in some cases, you almost could date them if you're, you know, if mm-hmm. that was all the right way. I mean, it was that, you know, casual and whatever, but it also was limited in what my sons could do and would be exposed to.
Right.
So, you know, you could make a case for either, you know, scenario, you know, small family or familiar, smaller school system with that sort of friendships and stuff.
And there's a number of Grand Canyon National Park families that try to leave to get their kids in high school in a bigger school where they're littler fish in a bigger sea.
Yeah.
Instead of big fish in a tiny little fishbowl. Just for that sort of broadening of horizons reason. But it's tough because the parents have their careers and they're trying to work all that out too.
Yeah.
So that whole concept of required occupancy and trying to build equity and at the same time have good quality education for your family, your children. There's a lot of moving parts there.
Yeah, no, it's pretty complicated actually. And while I was in Death Valley, Yosemite, and Grand Canyon, I interacted with families regularly who sent their kids away. And I think you even know the name of the school.
Right, to the Wasatch Academy.
At Wasatch Academy.
Yeah.
Which, from a Park Service standpoint, had a real close relationship with the parks. And I don't know how that came about, but I do know that a lot of families, particularly at the high school level, would send their kids up there.
For decades. Well, of course, Grand Canyon didn't have a high school since its 1919 forward to, what, the 1950s.
Oh, is that right?
Late 50s, yeah. I don't think so. And so, at eighth or ninth grade, it was go to Williams or Flagstaff or Wasatch or someplace else.
I guess I sort of forgot that. I mean, I knew they went to Wasatch, but I didn't remember or didn't even maybe know about the high school.
Yeah, I think that came in later. I'm not exactly sure of the date, but but there was. It was so lots of moving parts with that. Maybe this is a good point to wrap up this part 17 interview, and in part 18 we'll dig into some of the nuts and bolts of the job in Washington, D.C.
Well, if you insist, we can do that.
All right, then. Well, with that, this will wrap up Part 17 Oral History Interview with Butch Farabee. My name is Tom Martin. Today is Monday, July 6th, 2020. And Butch, thank you so very much.
My pleasure. Thank you.